I know the kind of pain you're feeling, Alex. I once had it myself.
You some kind of doctor?
No, Alex. I am Magneto, and I have come to offer you sanctuary.
Welcome to Season 3 of the Grounded Futures Podcast. This is the show where we discuss topics that are important to our collective survival and thrival. We also dig into ways youth, and anyone really, can gain new skills to thrive amid current and ongoing disasters. This season's meta theme is all about trust. Trust in ourselves, trust in our work and art, and trust in each other. We are your hosts, William and Carla.
Welcome to our show. We produce Grounded Futures on Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh lands, but our guests are from around the world. A big thank you to Zach Bergman for our show music, and a big thank you to Robin Carrico for our show art.
And before we start today's show, here is a short jingle from one of our pals over at Channel Zero Network.
Hello, and welcome to We Will Remember Freedom, a monthly podcast of anarchist fiction. I'm your host, Margaret Kiljoy. Hello, and welcome to Live Like the World is Dying, your podcast for what feels like the end times. I'm your host, Margaret Kiljoy. Hello, and welcome to the jingle for both of my podcasts. I'm your host, Margaret Kiljoy. You can find my podcasts wherever you get your podcasts or get them from the Channel Zero Network.
Lynn's Amer creates LGBTQ plus and intersectional social justice media for kids and families. They created their beloved LGBTQ plus family web series, Queer Kid Stuff, in 2016, which now has 4 million lifetime views and counting. Their debut book, Rainbow Parenting, Your Guide to Raising Queer Kids and Their Allies, publishing on May 30th, 2023 with St. Martin's Press. Currently, they host the Rainbow Parenting podcast and perform at schools and libraries across the country, while also writing and consulting for children's television. They worked with Nick Jr. on the Webb Award-winning Blue's Clues and You Pride Parade music video. The fabulous show with Faye and Fluffy on upcoming episode of an extremely popular show, and more. You can watch their TED Talk on why kids need to learn about gender and sexuality now with more than 2.5 million views. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me and for that lovely introduction.
So many good things.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
How are you doing today?
I am doing good. Things are wild. My schedule is just like one of those times when it just like picked up really quickly. Mm-hmm. And now mm-hmm. I'm just like, ugh, so right. many things to juggle all at the same time. But today's been good. So good. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us during such an extraordinarily busy time.
I love coming on podcasts and chatting with cool people. So this is a lovely little end to my day.
Okay, yeah, good. Perfect. Right. That's perfect.
Right. You want to start off?
Yeah, I'll start off with the first question then. Okay. Before we dig into your work on Queer Kid Stuff, the podcast, and the Rainbow Parenting book, and so on, we have a question for you. Our show opens with Magneto rescuing a kid and offering him sanctuary. And we were scrolling through your Twitter feed and saw a tweet from last summer where you wrote, "The X-Men owe Magneto an apology." Let's go into the nerdverse of Magneto and why do you feel that?
Oh my God, I can't believe you scrolled all the way back to our Twitter feed. Carla and I talked about your Magneto essay in the Trust Kids book when we were on my podcast. And the Magneto obsession dates way back to before reading that. Yeah, Magneto was right. is the short of it all. What was the question again?
It was just like
the ending bit.
Why do you feel that way about
why do I feel that way?
Hey, what does X-Men owe Magneto an apology?
Yeah. Oh man. Because he was traumatized and from the Holocaust and there was just so little grace for his radicalism coming out of such a violent experience for him. And in his, you know, essentially triggered response to what was happening, what's happening kind of like currently in the, and I'm a kind of a movie person on the X-Men thing. I'm not really in the comics. So that's, I don't have a lot of background in that side of the storytelling of it all, but at least from the like first movies, and those are, I'm a millennial. I grew up on those films and superhero stuff. And yeah, watching it back now as an adult, I did like a rewatch of like all of the X-Men movies a couple of end of 2022-ish. And the trauma that he in particular suffered from the Holocaust that then gets pulled back into his life in a really profound way through the movies and through the kind of modern story of it all is just, it's really intense. And like, and it just gives so much context for all of his decisions. And as a Jewish and trans person, it's just become even more profound. And I think it goes beyond even the parallels to Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. That's like a helpful starting place to like think about it. But I think that there's also the context that we have now on those two historical figures, right? Of like COINTELPRO and like that they actually were friends and that they were supportive of each other's missions, and our white supremacist history has pitted them against each other. And it's interesting to take all of that context to the X-Men movies and see. Yeah, I don't think that Xavier was like totally wrong, and I think your essay got at that too, but I do think that like it's so important to think about, okay, how can these two philosophies of organizing, right, work with and for each other instead of pitting them against each other. And this is all getting into conversations about coalition and yeah. Way to kick off the podcast with the Holocaust.
I mean, we asked the questions about
it's
that.
Great, it's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, no, that's a great answer. Yeah, I grew up watching the X-Men movies a bit, and I've always been a fan of Magneto. He's always been mm-hmm. one of my favorites. Because it's like you say, with the trauma and stuff like that, like that's mm-hmm. that's totally part of it for sure. And I think like also like finding other mutants, and then they're all like doing what Xavier's doing of kind of following in the capitalism, kind of doing the thing that's like, it's like he's not entirely wrong because he's getting the support and he's doing the things to like make sure everyone's safe and stuff, but they're safe, but are they free? You know, it's like, and Magneto is like, he's not exactly safe in some of the choices he's made, but he feels mm-hmm. free. Mm. The people that follow him feel more free and stuff. And I think that's, yeah, it's a cool.
I like that framer.
And he's
queer. I
mean,
the canon.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was like, I don't know how much I was just like, oh yeah, Magneto when I was a kid. Yeah. But I also think that like, I've always been drawn to villain characters because villains for the most part are queer coded in a lot of ways. And I mean, that's a very complicated, long conversation to have.
Yeah. we don't need to go into the fact that all villains and shows are usually either queer or people of color or...
Yeah, but the thing that I think that folks don't think about always when we're talking about queer coding of villains that relates back to my work is mm-hmm. that especially when you're looking at like Disney movies and the queer coding of the villains in animated films and the history of that, a big reason why that happened is because a lot of the animators behind those characters were queer and couldn't express their queerness in their art. And so it ended up being exactly. They put it into their artwork in the way that they could, because they could code it as they could code villains as queer. And like fabulous, like Ursula is an incredible example of this.
Yeah.
Based on the drag queen. Well,
even the one from Lion King,
Scar.
Scar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like he, the way he sings is like,
oh, yeah.
So queer.
Yeah. I love this. Oh, I hope you write something about this, or maybe you already have, because there's an essay going around right now. I don't know if you've seen it. I was actually so irritated I couldn't even open it, but it's probably in the terrible New York Times. But it said something about we're in these dangerous times of rewriting villains as heroes, was the headline. And I was like, immediately was like, this is going to be terrible.
Terrible. I feel like, yeah. It's such a complicated thing. I feel like it's that, you know, that meme where it's like the brain like gets like bigger and bigger and like more, it goes down the slots. And I'm just kind of like, okay, this is like villains, like are awful, bad people.
The black and white
then,
thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like, villains are queer coded. That's like cool because there's representation. Then it's like queer villains are bad because that's coding queer people as evil. And then it's like, oh, that's the only way the queer animators could express themselves in the 50s and 60s.
No,
love it.
That's perfect.
I think I need to get better at making memes.
Memes are so powerful.
Hilarious.
Well, yay Magneto, thank you for
yay Magneto for sure.
And just a little side note, Stan Lee himself didn't see him as a villain as such.
Antagonist.
More antagonist, more a little bit of an anti-hero maybe, but not a villain. He was really clear about that.
Stan Lee is
also
rad.
Fans very heavily ship him with Xavier, and it's great.
I love it.
Because the movies, especially
Patrick Stewart and
and
they're like best friends.
They're like best friends, and one of them is queer, and they're just like it's so queer on screen. It's so great.
Sir Ian McKellen. Yes. They're a good dynamic duo.
They are.
Okay, well, thanks for starting off with the nerdverse with us.
Oh my gosh,
we couldn't help because our show opens with a Magneto voice.
I love it.
Okay. I'm going to talk a bit about your fabulous book that's coming out in May, because I was privileged to have an advanced copy and it was such a joy to read and inspiring, and thank you for your work. It's called Rainbow Parenting, Your Guide to Raising Queer Kids. And their allies.
That's important. It's an important
part. Really important part. Sorry, I had a space on my page. So, I'm going to read it again. Rainbow Parenting, Your Guide to Raising Queer Kids and Their Allies. And you begin the book with your mission statement, Spread Queer Joy. In there you write, queer for me and my life has been the center, the rule, not the exception. And joy is unbridled happiness, kindness, rainbows, unicorns, glitter, and the best of our collective wildest imaginations. So much is held in these three words, spread queer joy. They are the blanket that confronts, the shield that protects, the glitter that glimmers, and the balm that heals. I had to read it. And just give the audience, you know, the people listening, just a little taste of your writing. It's so beautiful. It also has a lot of humor in it. But anyways.
Which is perfect.
I am Jewish. I like to be funny.
Yes, exactly. Humor is just, it's just weaved through every page.
Humor, and it keeps people alive.
Exactly. Such a,
even people in the darkest situation. Oh, did my mic just turn off?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I can hear you.
I can't hear myself anymore, so.
No, you're really loud. You're good.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, even people in the darkest situations make humor.
Yeah, so it's absolutely. Perfect.
We're also trying to be entertaining and relatable and accessible.
It's such an accessible book. Thank you for doing it. Can you maybe tell us about the book, why you did it, and maybe some of your hopes for it as it's making its debut onto the world?
Yeah. It's coming out May 30th, which is just inching closer and closer every day, which is equal parts exciting and terrifying. The book. Where do I even start? I feel like the seed of the book really started with my TED talk. So I did a TED talk in summer of 2019, and that did well and was one of those bucket list check mark things to check off, and people seemed to It spoke to people, I think. And I went to my literary agent who I had signed with, I think like a year or two prior, because I had wanted to publish a picture book. And that takes a lot longer and is a lot harder to do, which we discovered. And I was like, I have this literary agent. I want to write a book, whether that's a picture book or like, I was like, maybe I could do a nonfiction something. And I kind of saw the reaction to the TED Talk and I was like, maybe I could turn this into a book. And then we started writing the proposal, because I don't know how many people know this, but most nonfiction books are bought on proposal. You don't have to write the full manuscript, which is different than fiction. And it took a long time to get the proposal together because I had never written a nonfiction proposal. And then the pandemic hit and lockdown happened and slowed everything down, especially the already glacial publishing industry. And then we ended up kind of still putting it together somehow and went out on submission with it. So put it out to different publishers and editors in, I want to say like January, February of 2021. And from there, everybody passed on it, by the way, except for maybe one person. And we got kind of like notes back. And so I had to revise the proposal. And the proposal at this point does not at all reflect what the final version of the book is. I think it's a much better book for it. But yeah, and I've been working on it ever since we officially sold it in March of 2021. And I've been writing it pretty much ever since. It's 2 years almost after. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Right now, when we're recording this, March of 2023 is about 2 years since I sold it. And then it's going to come out in May. So that's wild. But yeah, calling it a parenting book is more for marketing than it is for a reflection of what's in the book. It's a bit of a misnomer because it's not a parenting guide like you would look at what to expect when you're expecting, or like anything that's like super practical about like, this is when your baby's gonna start smiling and things like that. I would say that this book is more of a philosophy on like how to raise young people in a way that is queer and gender affirming. And that is just like through a lot of different ways. So through their environment, through the language that you use around them, throughout, and it kind of takes it section by section through the different kind of like age phases of early childhood. So from infancy to toddlerhood, there's a specific chapter on kind of like preschool age, because that's a very significant age, that like 3-4 age, that it's very significant in learning about gender and gender identity. Or at least I want people to be thinking that it's a significant age to be getting that information to their kids. That's the tactic of it all, right? Getting behind the scenes a little bit. And then it goes kind of like kindergarten plus. So kind of moving out of early childhood and into like more complicated things. And that's kind of like the meat of the book. But preface to all of that, there's a really chunky section of just like completely stripping down the reader's stigmas around queerness and transness and childhood. And that was a really, really important thing to do, because the way I like to think of the book is like, all right, we got a big pool of stuff that we got to wade through, right? And I am your guide who is going to very slowly, step by step, lead you into the deep end. We're not diving straight into the 10-foot side of the pool. We're going to walk nice and slow. I'm going to hold your hand and we're going to go inch by inch. And as you know, before you know it, you're going to be, you know, nose deep in water. And you're not even going to notice it happened. That's kind of the how the book should feel. But Carly, you've read the book, and not a lot of people have read the book yet. I've just been reading it over and over again for the past 2 years.
I mean you've captured it. Yeah, it's I think it's really important, the part about the it's not really just for parents or parenting in that way. Mm-hmm. And I would even push it, it's like really about relationships. Mm-hmm. Between folks who support young people, so in any place, public or private. I really captured that. Really was an invitation to anybody who's maybe in the adult zone of their life.
Anyone who is in relationship with young people, exactly, in really any way. Thinking of parenting not as like child parent, but as in like the relationship between people who theoretically raise children.
Mm-hmm. And you also did a beautiful job of weaving in the intersections of oppression and other systems of oppression without being didactic. It was just, it's just so beautiful. And like I said, there's humor, and your mission statement of queer joy is what the book is. Like it's on every page. It is the ethos that runs through it. And it's just stunning. I think that, you know, I want people who know my work well, know that I don't write handbooks per se. And so it's genuine when I say this is like doing something unique and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it is really getting to that nuance between the difference of being a guide and a didactic stand above everybody's teacher or professing. So it really is, you're walking with people and you really feel it.
Thank you. That really means a lot, because
it's true.
It was really hard.
I know.
Because there is that really in that tension that I felt as I was writing it between like being too prescriptive versus like really approaching it as a philosophy. And like there are some things that I do have to explain how to explain. And that's like already hard, but I'm also trying to like talk about like my own personal experience, just like growing up as a trans person and like my experience working with young people, whether they're queer or trans or whatever. And it's weaving all of that together. Oh my gosh, this book took so much out of me. but I hope that all of that effort speaks to the page and like it's useful is all that I can really hope for. And I think the dedication that I have at the beginning of the book really says it all. If you want to read that. Do you have that in front of you?
I did have it, because I was like, I was going to read it, because you're right, it is so beautiful, but I would love you to say it.
My dedication at the top of the book is, it says, "For trans kids, I hope this helps." And that is about as true and honest as I can be, is that like I wrote this book because I hope that it changes things. And I don't want to be so hubristic that I think that it like will so change the trajectory of everything that's going on right now, but I hope I can at least make some sort of dent, because this is a book with a big five publisher and it's got reach, and it's publishing in a moment that I think is really, this has always been the intersections of queerness, transness, and kids, and like visibility of that, those intersections have always been hot and spicy. And that this, I talk about this a lot in therapy, of just like the double-edged sword of my work, where like I get to put out this like beautiful stuff into the world and it's met with so much love, but also so much hate. And that is just the nature of what I do, and there's no real escape from that. And I just hope that like we're able to hit the nail in a way that like we can really make something happen and get this like essentially new parenting philosophy, new child raising philosophy into the world in a significant way. Like, I want, and I think my publisher wants this book to be the book you get for every one of your friends when they're having a baby shower. Like, that is, like, this is the book that you get when you're getting someone what to expect when you're expecting. And yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah, that was beautiful. That was really beautiful.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it will. It's going to spread.
100%.
It's going to have ripple effects beyond, like, you. Just, you won't even probably see that the multitudes of lives that are going to be changed, because it's going to be so massive. And those things are subtle, like the private home and the private lives of folks doesn't always make it to the internet, because that's where the extremes are.
Yeah.
It's
going to reach people. Mm-hmm. It's going to reach the right people.
And it's just going to spread.
Yeah. We're manifesting it together in this conversation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No. 100%.
Yeah. And it's really, you can tell that you wrote it a little bit. I don't know. I don't want to assume this, but I feel like it was like, must have been so healing. Like, you were writing it for yourself, for little you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, like, I mean, that's the thing with, like, I think a lot of my work is that there's, like, a healing about it. And it's not necessarily something I do on purpose. I don't, like, write something in order to heal myself. But, like, or, I mean, sometimes I do. But I think, like, that's something that I've started to notice more about my work, especially, like, as I, as a human, have worked on healing, is I can see the ways in which my, like, creativity helped me heal as, like, a part of that journey for myself, but also, like, how, because that happens for me when I am creative in these ways, it also helps other people heal. So that's just kind of, like, an interesting thing that started happening in my work that I think has been happening for a long time, and people have communicated to me for a very long time. I just didn't know how to tune into that for a while, and I think I've finally, like, found that frequency. Yeah, I hope that I can put a little bit of healing out into the world, because I think we just need a lot more of that.
Absolutely.
I think there are a lot of hurt people out there.
Put that out there.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful. Yeah. Oh, should I move on to the? Okay.
Yeah. So they're connected.
Yeah, they're connected. Yeah, it's connected. So this is a pile of different things that we'll go into. Okay. I had a chance to read some of the episodes of Watch, not read. Yeah. Okay. I had a chance to watch some of the episodes of Queer Kids Stuff, and it's super fun and accessible. I love that it's really for all ages, like any age can watch it, really. And it's just, yeah, thank you for doing that. I wish I had it when I was a kid, because it is, it's amazing. And it makes me want to highlight some of the gender and queer affirming moments too, because part of dominant culture narrative is to keep us queer folks as experiencing fear and other things in the world, of just feeling in that, oh, we're hated by everyone and everyone and blah, 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 blah. That's not us.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, would love to hear your thoughts on that. But also, here's two other topics I'd like to talk with you about and hear from you on. And I will go into these eventually. One is how you use anti-trans versus transphobia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to hear about why you do that. And the other topic is... this one I'll delve into on personal story stuff of intersections between sexism and anti-gay stuff, and that connected to transphobia.
Ooh, that's an interesting one.
I'll talk about my, because no one can see me, but I pass really well. So I deal with my own things that
Oh my god, I'm excited to dig into that. That is a complicated and interesting inside baseball, and I love inside baseball.
But yeah, I was wanted to ask about the anti-trans versus transphobia. And
sure. Did you want to get to the web series first?
Oh, yeah. We can do that first. Yeah.
Yeah. There's yeah, like, yeah. That was a multifaceted question. Yeah. Usually I asked that question, but Liam Uli took on that today.
It's great. It's great. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. Queer. I love what you're talking about with queer kid stuff and that like the all ages aspect of it, because that's something I talk about all the time, because I think that like the secret to good kids work is that it's intergenerational. And I think like that is a really important piece of what I do, because what you're talking about of this like fear mongering and isolation of queer people, it's about not just like isolating from each other, but isolating us between generations, right? So that we cannot raise new generations of queer and trans people, which is what we're seeing happening right now politically, right? An attack literally on young trans and queer kids so that they don't grow up to be queer and trans adults, right? That is the point of all of this. But two, just so we can't get knowledge from our in-community elders, right? And I'm not trying to like position myself as an elder, because I'm not in the queer and trans community, but like I have had experiences and I am older than a 5-year-old, right? And I have more knowledge than a 5-year-old and am in community in different ways than a 5-year-old is. And but that's also true for a 91-year-old in community or out of community. And it's about stitching our community back together, right? From like being this like quilt that's been torn apart and sectioned off into these spaces. Here you're a queer trans elder. One, you're going to be oppressed by ageism and shoved into, you know, nursing homes. Maybe you're lucky and you're in SAGE and you're in LGBTQ plus community. I mean, so many LGBTQ plus elders didn't survive the AIDS crisis, right? So like there's, I mean, bringing it back to genocide, right? And I mean, that's something that the Jewish community has been through, that the indigenous communities have been through. It's something that really tears apart, you know, systems of knowledge, right? And histories. And that is a really profound loss. And that's something that you have to actively work to rebuild. And I think like, if we're gonna get macro with it, right? Like that's kind of what I'm trying to do, is like get us back in touch with young people so that we can rebuild an intergenerational queer and trans community, right? Because that's how we survive, is we have people around us and we support each other in these oppressive systems that don't want us to survive and don't want us to continue to raise young people into our spaces and don't want us to take care of the oldest among us who have the knowledge of how to get through these oppressive times, because they've lived through it before. They've survived the AIDS crisis. They've survived the Holocaust. We will one day hopefully be elders who survived this political onslaught against trans people. Like history happens. I'm not a historian, but like history happens in cycles, right? And like we can learn really important lessons from the people who came before us. And the oppressors know that if we don't have access to that knowledge, we can't stop them. And I think, you know, queer kid stuff is just like a preschool series where I'm talking with my teddy bear and a ukulele about like, what does the word queer mean? And that episode is like the very first episode of the series, and it comes directly from the queer theory classes that I was taking like in college. And that's like, how do you put bell hooks into a preschool show? And like that episode is how I tried to do that, right? And like it's about distilling it to the simplest like core of what the truth is and what that piece of knowledge is, and making it so that literally anyone can understand it. And I think that that's what I happen to be good at somehow, and also something that's just really important for disseminating knowledge, especially on like such a massive scale that we have access to communication in this day and time with internet and technology. And that's something that our ancestors did not have access to. That is a huge back to the double-edged sword thing, right? Right? The internet's such a beautiful and monstrous thing. And we can use that to our advantage, but they also can't, our oppressors can too. I mean, that's the whole thing with like, the superhero stuff is like, you know, the people we're fighting also have superpowers. But yeah, at least, if we can, I don't know, it's all community building, coalition building. It all just keeps coming back to all of that. Right.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's perfect. I loved all the stuff about different generational stuff and all of that and whatnot, because it's like, yeah, even old elders can learn, and they can grow and learn from different things and past experiences and other things and whatnot, and can learn from kids, and the youth can learn from old and whatnot. And I mean, like, thinking like ever since I was a little kid, like, I mean, I was born into like a really fortunate household, and I've taught these guys a lot of things. They've taught me a lot of things. Like, it's been very queer positive. But I've also, you know, like, thinking about history with when talking about that, like, I have gone through so many different obsessions with eras and times anti-queerness. Mm-hmm. Pre that, when queer was just a normal thing, was just mm-hmm. like just a chill thing that just happened in the everyday. It was whatever. Yeah. Like, it was like the only reason that they ever were like, maybe you as a guy shouldn't get with a guy, was like, we kind of need to like repopulate. That was like the only reason they were like, okay, you can do that for like the romance, and like, you guys, like, it's really cute, but like, we need to like make kids because we're like dying. <It's>
like, it was like the future of humanity. No.
Yeah, you know.
They didn't have IVF back then.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. It's that double-edged sword again. Technology.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Is like, that delves also into, with technology, how we have it now is, like you said, like, it's spread queerness a lot. So many more people in the world have learned about trans people and queer people and just people of color and different things that they have to go through, you know, all the terrible stuff that happens in the world. But on the other end of that, like you said, the shitty people also now have access to everything. And yeah, they can spread their agenda as well online, and they can spread their agenda to different corners of the world that didn't originally have that agenda, and now they do. So it's the double-edged sword, like you said, with online. It's and it's good to have stuff like what you're creating out there as well to mm-hmm. fight yeah, against
thank
it.
You.
So it's really great.
Yeah, I try.
Yeah, and I love the intergenerational. I mean, it's what I care most about, is intergenerational and getting rid of the yeah. social borders mm-hmm. between ages, because it's the only way we're going to actually survive. And it's actually probably the only way we really truly thrive
yeah.
is when we work across ages. And you know, an empire or the hegemony or the ruling class or whatever, capitalism, yeah. The 10 monstered being thing that controls systems yeah. really wants us to silo our movements and keep mm-hmm. them separate along oh, yeah. age and everything. And it's yeah, I love that at the core of why you do what you do. I didn't realize that in that way, so I'm glad you said mm-hmm. that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I definitely didn't go into it thinking that mm-hmm. I was just like yeah. I went into it, you know, I mean, I went into like an undergrad theater program, like thinking I was going to be like a musical theater performer on the Broadway, and ended up falling in love with children's storytelling through theater. And like, it was like the one thing that cast me when I was a freshman in college. And I just like, it just hit something for me. And I don't know exactly what it is, but it reminded me of like how I felt growing up with like Disney and Pixar movies. Like, there's just something so, they're just like good children's storytelling really gets at just like universal truths. And there's something, I don't know. This is the part of my work where I'm just kind of like, this is the thing that I fell in love with. And it's led me on this path, right? And like, while I was in undergrad, kind of like learning that craft, right? And focusing on that, I was also starting to understand my identity as a queer person. I didn't even touch the gender identity stuff back then. We needed to take some very baby steps. But I wondered why those two things couldn't speak to each other. And I found that it really didn't exist at the time, or really still, I mean, to an extent, I think especially in theater, but also in larger mainstream media. I mean, I think that books have really made a lot of strides, I will say. But it's a space that's really lagged. And I have always kind of came into it from like the children's storytelling perspective. And then I honestly think over like the last like 3 or so years, especially during lockdown, I was just kind of like, you know, I can't, it's one thing to make something for kids and hope that they'll find it somehow, especially on like the internet as it is. But I realized you gotta get parents on board. You got to get adults on board, and it can't just be like the queer and trans folks who are already there with you. You gotta convert people, I guess, bring them in, get them to understand what we're about so that they can push it to their young people, because they really, this is like such a unique part about children's work, is that you have these gatekeepers in front of you, right? And like, that's first, there are reasons for that. I mean, like, especially in the world that we live in now, I mean, this is complicated, right? Like, you have, kids are vulnerable, right? And like, I talk about this in the book, that like, you know, we shouldn't want to protect children because they're like quote unquote innocent. We want to protect children because they're vulnerable, and because there are bad actors in the world who are trying to manipulate young people who don't have enough experience to discern a bad actor. And in, you know, however many ways you want to interpret that. And I think that I gotta convince parents and teachers and caregivers and all of the people that the book is for, right? This parenting idea that what I'm trying to say to young people is a good thing that's really important for them to hear, that they have many possibilities of who they are in their life and how they want to live out their life and who they want to be that are beyond what they're being told. And I think that that's a hard sell sometimes. And yeah, I think the book was the beginning of me trying to figure out, okay, how can I bridge the gap here? How can I sell better to adults? How can I get this to happen in spaces? How can I like create minions, right? How can I like, because I mean, I talk about this in the book too, that like I am one person and I can be a public role model. That's a persona that I play, right? That's a role I take on, but I'm still always just going to be one person. And if you're talking, if I am in a relationship, even parasocial, with a parent, a kid, and me on the screen, I am still not the most important person in that room to a child by any means. And I got to get that person to understand why I'm on the screen in the way that I am and why I'm presenting that information, and help them understand how to do it themselves as well. And like, that's how exponential growth happens, right? It's just a math equation.
Yeah. Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. And so much more.
Yeah.
There's a lot of care and beauty put into the work you do.
Yeah, exactly. That was awesome. That was beautiful.
And then you wanted to get into the phobia versus...
Yeah, the next thing is really important. Yeah, anti versus phobia.
The whole house had to hear me like, oh my God, listen to this.
Yeah, you went on a whole thing about it. It was really great.
Oh, good.
Never
good,
using
good.
Phobia again. Anyways, yeah. Please share.
Yeah, totally. So I started switching from the suffix phobia. So like transphobia, homophobia, et cetera, et cetera, to anti as a prefix. So anti-trans, anti-queer, anti-gay, et cetera. I think a couple of year, maybe a year or two ago. It's still relatively new for me, and I also definitely still use transphobia, homophobia, especially because they're like more legible as concepts sometimes. But the reason I do it is because bigotry is not fear-based. It's about oppression. It's about power. It's about, I probably put it so much more eloquently in the book. but it's, you know, it's fear can be rationalized. Like, fear is an understandable, relatable emotion. We can understand why someone might be scared of a spider, because a spider, you know, some spiders are poisonous and can kill you if they bite you. Like, that is a understandable fear. We know we don't want to die, most of us, and especially not by spider bite. But like, a person is not the same as a poisonous spider. A person's sexuality, a person's gender identity specifically, like, those are identifiers. They are parts of a person. They are not someone who's going to murder you because of that, right? Like, that is, so it doesn't make, like, linguistic logical sense to call a bigotry, a bias, a way of thinking about someone a fear, because fears are understandable. Bigotry, I think, is not, in the same way.
That is amazing. That made me think about how, you know, the saying of like, it wasn't the gun that killed you, it's the person holding the gun. It's like, oh, you know, oh, if you're afraid of people, you're afraid of people, but you can't be afraid of their identity. You can be afraid of, like, just because a killer is gay, that doesn't mean that they're a killer because they're gay. They're just a killer because they're a killer. Like, what else, you know? So putting the identity into a fear is not at all the same thing. Exactly.
Yeah. And conflating those things is dangerous.
Yeah.
Because it's actually hate, too, it's right? Hate.
Yeah.
And it's, and it kind of reminds
me. Exactly, just anti.
Yeah. One of my big, like, I'm not on social media anymore, but one of the things I was really upset with is the word pedophile. Pedophilia, because philia literally means to love something. That has, it has like zero thing, nothing to do with love.
These people hate kids. People just hate kids.
You know, there's like, it's so violent. But the power with language. Yeah. So I really appreciated that section. And, I sent a picture of it to the whole Brown at Futures crew on our Slack and said, let's make sure that we only use anti. So thank
really
you.
Really spread
so you
it.
Spread that seed already.
Good. Yeah. Good. Amazing. Yeah, I love
that's
it.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Already making a difference.
Thank you for that.
Exactly.
So important.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The next thing is the topic with intersections between sexism and anti-gay stuff and with connecting to trans. And I wanted to talk about that because I'm trans mask. I've been on testosterone. Like, I pass pretty well. And I noticed that because I pass well, you know, like, I've realized how me getting misgendered, I still will get misgendered. And it's not because I look like a girl. It will be because I'm dressed feminine or I have long hair. Cis boys get misgendered because they have long hair. Or I will literally just be hanging out with my friend that's really feminine presenting. And people just assume, oh, only two girls hang out, not a boy and a girl. They can't do that until they see my beard. And then they get, well, then they think I might be trans femme. Then they get really confused. So I wanted to talk about that because I've noticed that as well in so many other my friends and whatnot. Like, they won't get misgendered if they're presenting mask, and then they will if they're presenting femme. And it's not because they look like a girl and they don't pass. It's because of sexism and anti-gay. And it's totally that, you know, a cis man who's queer dressing really feminine will, dressing in a dress, people will assume he might be trans femme and misgender him. You know, So mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about that because it's a thing that I've noticed so much in my life. And there are transphobes. It's real. That is a thing. But some of these people, they can't just know on the spot if you're trans or not. They couldn't just see me and know that I'm trans or not. So
everyday cis person cannot discern a trans person.
Yeah. So half the time it's not transphobia. It is not active trans or anti-trans. Like, it's not active anti-trans. It's not that they're seeing us and are being anti-trans and are just like, I'm going to go be anti-trans to that trans person. They're it's sexism and other things. And sometimes it's literally just accidental assumption that you say, hey, actually, no, I'm a boy. And then they'll just be like, oh, okay. I didn't know that, blah, 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 the way you dress, whatever, you know, which is still not great, but you know, it's just a conversation I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, it's super meaty and complicated. And I think a big part of it too is understanding. I think there's so much to get into. The thing that's like first sparking for me that I want to kind of get into with it is that what you're talking about of like cis people discerning transness, like, I think you're right. I don't think that like the everyday normie cis person walking around has the discerning eye to spot a trans person just like walking down the street. But I do think that statement is not true when it comes to trans women. I think that trans misogyny is where public transphobia, anti-transness happens because of the visibility of trans women and trans femmes that is so violent and fear-mongered. And I mean, just everybody just go watch the documentary Disclosure, and like that will give you like the lesson you need in that, and like the horrific portrayal of trans women throughout film history in particular. But I think when it comes to trans masculinity and thinking about misogyny, because I mean, I'm non-binary and trans masculine. I have had top surgery, but I have not been on, I'm not on T, and I'm misgendered constantly because nobody knows how to perceive non-binariness in the world. But like, also, do I want people to do that? I think when I'm walking the way I like kind of talking about this and the way that I've heard others talk about it is like, what's your grocery store gender? What's your like perceived gender out in the wild? Right. And like, for me, I would love my grocery store gender to be they, them, but that's probably not going to happen too soon. Unless I get like a really cool Gen Z queer kid who's checking me out on the grocery store. And like, that's when it's happened, which has been great. But I think, train of thought, where are you, what happened to you? I was talking about grocery storage. Oh, what I'm going for is like general confusion at this point. That's where I feel like most satisfied in like other people's perception of me. I get served sometimes, and that's fun. I don't love getting she heard. That's not fun. But also, like, we're all still on an ever continuing journey of gender. That's not like I don't have an ending place for that or anything. I necessarily like want that to be eventually. And that's just a thing to think about. But, getting back to it, sorry, end of the day for a neurodivergent brain means lots of threads. So yeah, I think that it's complicated because, I don't know, I'm not a binary trans man, but a lot of binary trans men that I know aren't men and therefore don't, by the definition of the word, experience quote unquote misogyny, right? But a trans man has been socialized as a woman and as female and went through probably most of their childhood, depending on who you are and what kind of good or bad parents you had, you know, good, bad, not being a good binary, That's complicated. But probably went through their formative years experiencing misogyny for most of their life. And that just makes, I mean, it's the same thing too for like, I mean, I can't speak at all for trans women. This is where I like point to like incredible trans women who's spoken on, like Jules Gill Peterson is incredible. Raquel Willis, Janet Mock, Laverne Cox, just like all of these incredible people who've spoken on this, like, and are very, very smart about this. But, you know, trans women are socialized generally as men, but like but the toxic masculinity of that culture is incredibly harmful and damaging and violent. And so talking about trans misogyny is a very different conversation than trans masculine people experiencing misogyny. And this is just so complicated. There's just so much to it, because like also you were talking about passing, and like, for me, like, I don't know what it means to pass as non-binary. That's just like not even a thing, right? But like someone who presents and is generally perceived as cis male when you're a trans man, like, is so different when you're getting misgendered as female. Oh man, I don't even know where to go, because it's just it's this. I mean, this is also just like an ongoing conversation in community.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it's a conversation I have every day.
Yeah,
I really liked all the different things that you said, though, and they were all. Yeah, they all made really good points. And yeah, no, definitely. Like, when I speak on this stuff, I can never speak on trans women's, like, and I mean, like I said, like, what I end up getting, though, is I've had a lot of people think I'm trans femme. I've had a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And then why I get misgendered is they think they're misgendering me as male. They think they are, but then I'm like, actually, you're right.
That's such
such a complicated thing.
Just like thinking about like people's perception of you, but then also like how you're performing your gender to the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And like how you were socialized and how that influences your behavior. And then also like how whoever is in like the gender power of that moment, right, is like what kind of power they have over you, be it physical, if it's what kind of relationship that is, even if it is a stranger who's just taller than you, right? Mm-hmm. And like how especially trans guys and trans masculine people who are generally on the shorter side,
right? Oh yeah, yeah. Exactly. Right? Yeah, I deal with that. Yeah,
exactly. And it's just it's so tough, because I don't really think that there's an agreed upon like term for it, right? Because I am not a woman, and yet I do experience misogyny because I am perceived as female light by a lot of people who interact with me in my grocery store gender, right? Yeah, and that
grocery store gender is great.
Yeah, right. Right. Isn't that great?
I've been called sir, and it was like the best moment of my life in a grocery store when I was first coming out. I was like, me and my friend actually got we're both trans mask, and we've had someone in the store be like, are you guys brothers? And we were both like,
oh my god.
We were like 15. Cute.
Yeah, we were like 15. We were like so excited.
Oh my god, that's amazing. I love that. Yeah, it's really complicated, and like it's because like because in so many ways, like, trans masculinity has, and it's so hard to like not compare trans masculine to trans feminine too in this conversation, but they're just so different, because like there is a privilege to trans masculinity, right? Because you're not, trans masculine folks are not perceived threat to the patriarchy in the same way that trans women are and trans femmes are, because we're in the like scale of power within gender norms, right? Like, we're moving up, we're trying to, like, theoretically, this is all just like,
we're like moving from, you know, femininity and like cis women, trans women are, I don't know, maybe this is a I'm being problematic talking about all this in this way, but I probably am. But this is like, it's complicated. So I'm just, we're working it out as we're talking, because, you know, as you move away from any kind of femininity, feminists, even like butch cis women, like you're not targeted with misogyny in the same way, because you're, there's part of like the sexualization of women and femininity that's in there. There's like, what is like the root of like misogyny is like this like anti-femness, right? And like, that's different than like a woman who is butch or masculine. And there's something like invisibilizing about that move toward masculinity when you like, I don't know, start in a feminine space or socialize in like a beginning feminine way. And you're kind of like moving toward this like ultimate power, which is like cis, like masculine men, right? And like the like epitome of like toxic masculinity. You're moving toward that. And that's not threatening to them, because you're not, no matter what you do, you will never be in that space. You will never be in that space safely, right? And because you weren't born into it, and you have to be born into it, right? And trans women are kind of giving that up, right? They're leaving that space. And that's what those big macho men are so terrified of, is like any kind of threat to their own cis masculinity. And I just don't think that they're threatened by trans masculinity in the same way.
Yeah. You, I agree. Your first thing.
Well, I mean, Liam's always talked about this, and I've always appreciated it. And it's a nuance that I think is beautiful that you, I hear what you're saying, that we're getting into some very nuanced, complex stuff. Very. And
that everyone will have their own opinions on
it. Like in our family, like Ali's brother, Zach, who's a cis male, but very, mm-hmm. quite feminine, and was
effeminate,
I mean, I would say more than, that's the word, and was definitely bullied for it, and
he was misgendered as a kid,
always seen as queer, and like not just super cishet, has autism, so like presents in different ways, but and Liam talks about how he has more masculinity just externally than Zach, and
out in the world it's like I get less of the looks of like, oh, that's a effeminate person.
It's than like, there's like more, you almost have wield more power in this nuanced way.
Yeah.
Zach has had the privilege of patriarchy that goes way back. Like when we were at the park, when they were young, Zach always was asked what he was thinking and what he was doing. Mm. Liam was always remarked on his behavior and what he looked like and his clothes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And like across the board, we never ran into any adult who didn't do that, one of those two things. Huh. So that's like some extreme, like it's a testimony, but I was very plugged into it and very aware watching that happen.
And that's what the book is trying to disrupt, is even just those behaviors from adults of how they are treating young people and trying to like dismantle the way we gender young people. So sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't mean
100% 100%. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. And then all right. I also wanted to talk about with what you were talking about, and like, you know, we were talking about the patriarchy and men and all that. power.
Slash the hetero patriarchy.
Yeah. but I also, reminded about how like being trans mask, and so many other trans mask people also. And then we go into the conversation of TERFs and all that part of it, and how I have a hard time feeling safe in both washrooms. I don't feel safe in men's. I don't feel safe in women's, because even though I pass it, actually me passing as a man, I don't feel safe in men's because I just don't feel safe around cis men. But then I can't go into the women's because everyone's going to give me side eye and freak out because I look like a cis man.
Yes.
And I think like that is another nuanced conversation that is a part of this as well. The conversation of TERFs and damage to trans mask and trans femme people. And I, as a trans mask person, have dealt with a lot of the fetishization. That's my speech practice. Yeah. trans women have this too, of just being trans, the fetishized about me and my identity. And I've especially a lot of cis women I've had, they feel like they can be more touchy with me and can be more like up in my business, blah, 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 you know, whatnot, because, oh, there's anti-trans stuff caught up in there, as well as weird fetishized stuff of like, yo, you're trans, so like I can still be near you because you're technically still a woman. And like I've gotten that so much as when I was first coming out.
It comes down to genitalia, which is gross.
Exactly, right? That is exactly what it is. I don't have top surgery yet too. I it's full on, like, who cares if my face seems to pass? It's like to a lot of cishet women, they feel like they can be really close with me and all these and all whatnot because, oh, I'm not a cis man, so it's fine. But it's like, but I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah, but then there's also the
touch
like
people non-consensually.
Oh god, yeah. I mean, there's also just like the like gender traitor stuff of it all too, right? Of the like, I feel this sometimes from like cis queer women in particular, where it's you know, like, oh, like Lynn's is like, there's like a leaving femininity behind kind of thing, like leaving it's so hard to put into words because it's just something that I so and this is like not where my like work is in these, like, I mean, I think about all this stuff, obviously, like I have to be thinking at a really high level in order to be able to do the like 101 stuff that I do. But I don't always have to articulate it. And when I do, I'm usually told like, you're probably explaining this to a cis person. Like I had, I can't probably speak too specifically about it, but I just had a consulting, I do consulting on like mainstream kids media and stuff like that, and I just had a really, really interesting consulting gig, the first like kind of like good, like interesting in like a good way consulting gig that I've had, because a lot of them are just like emotional labor, which is why I don't do a lot of them anymore. But it had to do with this like TV spot about a business run by a trans girl and her dad, and their audience for their business is other trans girls, but the spot is on a national television thing, and cis people are probably the majority of the audience for that spot, so the way that they speak about their business had to be shifted so that it could accommodate a cis gaze, right? And that was a really complicated thing to have to say in an email to an executive about how to change, just like tweaking some of the visuals on the spot, because of the nature of that business and the way that it speaks to other trans girls. Is like, you know, if this was an ad for that was aimed at a mostly queer audience, especially a mostly trans audience, I would have been like, yeah, this is awesome. Go ahead. Maybe tweak this like one narrative thing. You're good to go. But this, I had to be really discerning and say, okay, we've got to take out this B-roll because it insinuates this. And it, yeah, having to explain like the difference between the trans gaze and the cis gaze to an executive was a different scale. So sorry, that's just why I'm saying, like, I'm thinking aloud in a lot of this, and this is all nuanced stuff that I'm maybe not as articulate about as I usually am, because this is so meaty and like is I mean, I love being able to talk about this stuff because I don't get to usually, and it's so complicated.
Yeah, that's great. I like that.
Yeah,
This is how people really get, I mean, people really get moved by story. So yeah. I appreciate
it. Yeah, it's awesome.
I appreciate your vulnerability.
Yeah, I have these conversations every day in my house, so I'm excited to talk about it on the show. And just, I mean, it really sparked when you mentioned the gender traitor thing. Mm-mm. That is like that I experienced, especially after going on testosterone. Like the testosterone is what really affected the traitor thing for a lot of people. And like it just like taking that medical route. It's like, oh, you full on just you're just full on leaving. You're not a little girl anymore. Oh no, I'm so, you know, like it's like it,
yeah, like so you've many... left the like feminist fight that we're all in.
Yeah,
but it's and like it's like no, I'm like I'm a trans person.
Yeah, it's like, can you go back and read your bell hooks, because you're really internalizing some serious patriarchy with these statements.
Yeah, you use the yeah, there is feminists are only cis women. It's like nope.
Yeah.
That is not at all what it is.
Well, then that circles all the way back to the conversation that started that, the question that started this, right? Is that like, do trans masculine people experience misogyny? Yeah. And like, my answer would be yes. It's just a different flavor of it, I guess. But it's not trans misogyny, which is an important distinction.
Very much.
Yeah. 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 But it, definitely experience their own thing.
Smash the patriarchy, the heteronormative
patriarchy.
Even cishet men are affected by it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's not great.
Yeah. Sorry, what am I doing next? How are you doing? We just have like our, the three questions that we kind of ask everybody.
Yeah, I'm doing great.
We're just pivoting.
Cool. Sounds good.
I know we could just talk. We'll have to have you back.
just so have to that's hang out.
Yeah, yeah. You, because I'm not doing
this. Okay. Great. I have another thing. Wow.
I know. Sorry. We can switch them.
We can switch them. Sure.
Okay. Okay. So this is, we get to get into my favorite topic, trust. And I'm just, we kind of were anchoring this season in this, the whole idea of trust and what it means to show up with trust, to trust yourself, to trust your path, your mission in life, why you're doing the things you do. And so we're just asking our guests, how does trust animate your life? Where does it show up? Where are the growth edges? All that good stuff.
Yeah, you're talking to a Scorpio sun. So trust is certainly a thing for me. I think I've always had trust in myself and in the direction I've wanted to go in my life, and like instinctually that's a very instinctual thing for me, and I haven't always been right about the exact thing that I've been going toward, but I've gone toward it nonetheless, and it's led me down different paths, right? And so the language around it has maybe changed, but it's always been the same kind of trajectory. And I think that there's something about that specific kind of trust in myself that I also think is just very stubborn, and just very focused and really focused, and I think has gotten me to where I am. So I think I've always had a lot of trust in myself. Trust in other people is much harder to come by. It's tough because I think I just, the whole point of the book, right, is that like I wish that my parents had this when I was like, my mom was pregnant with me. And I think as I've grown up, I think people, but also the world, have betrayed me in really profound ways. And it's been really, really difficult to build that back. And I can think about that on like a larger scale in my life, of like my gender identity and my sexuality and my neurodivergence and the difference between what I was told about myself and what I've had to discern was not true about myself, and like what actually is How can I dig for that truth? And who can I trust to tell me the information that I need to know about myself? And ultimately, it always comes back to, like, I am the only person that I can trust about myself, right? And I think strengthening that trust in particular has helped me trust other people, because then I can set manageable expectations for other people. And what I can trust them to tell me is accurate? Question mark. So yeah, I mean, this is trust in like a really nebulous kind of way of looking at trust, which I like. But it's, I think I've had to learn to be more skeptical, is a big part of it too, because I do a lot of work in systems change. Like, I do a lot of work in mainstream children's media. I'm in all of these different, I'm in TV film, I'm in publishing, I'm in, I don't know, this whatever like influencer industry is. Like, I am in a lot of spaces that are just so riddled with bigotry and bias. And like, those are the bedrock of these spaces, right? And I think I'm a pretty, despite all of this, what I'm saying, I think I'm a pretty optimistic person, actually. and I like to kind of see the sunny side of people and things, or at least I like to put that energy out, which is, there's a difference there. But I do think I've had to understand who the real people are, who I can trust, and who I can build things with. Because there's a difference there, right? There's a difference between, okay, like, who is someone who's gonna cheer me from the sidelines, and who is a person who is going to put in the blood, sweat, and tears to win this, I don't know, victory. I don't want to be like game theory all of it, but like, that's a lot of it too. Like, I'm playing a big old chess game with a lot of my career, and it is so important to be able to discern who is a cheerleader, who is someone in the stands, who is someone who is on your team, and who is someone who is helping you and is coaching you through strategically as well. Like, all of those, it's so easy to misinterpret who goes where. And for me, I've definitely trusted too quickly that someone is someone I've had a role that I perceived them to have, when actually they couldn't take that on for whatever reasons. And a lot of it is just anti-trans, anti-queer, anti-gay stuff that isn't always perceivable until you're like in the weeds with someone. Yeah, I'm talking very metaphorically about very specific situations. but hopefully that is a helpful way of talking about trust. I've had to learn to be more discerning in my trust, which has been hard.
Yeah, no, totally.
That's beautiful. I love it. I think it's really important. I always distinguish the difference between the trust you build over a long time with somebody who is showing up and isn't in competition with you at all. It supersedes you. You don't have to abandon yourself to earn that trust or anything like that. That's a different kind than like the everyday walking through the life. But I think you nailed it by saying it begins with yourself.
Yeah.
Because if you always trust yourself, it's going to always be okay.
Well, even if you trust yourself, and then even falling into accidentally trusting the wrong person, you can still fall back on yourself and move on from it and trust that, okay, that was a bad moment. Need to move on, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of falling into a bad headspace because of it.
Yeah. I think ultimately I've always trusted myself. It's just been, I just always haven't always been able to interpret it, right? Like, when I was a young person, like, confused and depressed teenager, like, struggling with my identity and like not understanding who I was, like, I trusted that feeling, right? That like, I was unhappy. I didn't know why. I didn't know what was causing the unhappiness. I didn't know where in myself that was coming from necessarily, but I knew that feeling was a true feeling that I felt at like the core of who I am. And I didn't know how to do anything about it because I didn't have any answers and I'm the only person I trust, right? And that's a tough place to be in, where like the only person you trust is yourself. And I've learned to grow that like inner circle for sure. I have a wife who's like my best friend, and we have two dogs, and I trust them for the most part. Maybe, I don't know, we have a puppy, so I trust him maybe 30%, and I trust our older dog maybe 80% on a good day.
Love it. Yeah. Amazing, amazing. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, animals, right? Animals is a great part of life.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. The Grounded Futures platform is based on the idea of thrivistance. A thriving now while resisting and surviving amid hard times and the horrors. So we'd love to hear some of the ways you cultivate thriving in the everyday.
Ooh. I think for me it's about it's sometimes it's easier. Some days are easier than others. I think especially when it comes to like neurodivergent burnout, I happen to be in a moment where I haven't been burned out for a while. And I think that this is like the longest stint I think I've had in a very long time where I haven't felt burned out, which is very nice. So I think in these kinds of spaces where I'm in, when I'm not in that kind of like depleted headspace, it's about just kind of like the simple pleasures, right? Of like, I love to cook. Like that's I love food. Like I love like a nice restaurant where I can like, you know, just like enjoy a glass of wine and like a beautifully cooked meal from someone who wasn't me sometimes, but then also like getting to be creative in like a very different way than I usually am. I think that something that I'm good at that's helped me in my work and my career is that I'm good at building relationships with people who care about who I am and what I do and why I do it, like you lovely folks. And I take pleasure in that. Like, that's fun for me. Like, this conversation is great. I love doing this. Like, that's what I was saying. Like, end my day with a podcast? Absolutely. Yes. And I mean, part of it's also like my Leo moon wants to just hear me talk about myself all the, all the time. But like that also is like a way that I fill myself up, right? Like performance has been a part of my life since I was a young kid. And that's because it fills something in me. And, you know, I teach and I perform, I sing every, you know, a lot of the week. And like, those are things that I do that just make me feel good and like are part of the day to day of my life. And I've woven those things in a purposeful way. And like, yeah, sometimes creativity can be hard, but I also think like there are things that I've made sure not to monetize in my career. And I think maybe if I wanted to leave all this behind, I would maybe go to culinary school, but like that's not this lifetime, right? And I need to keep some things a little sacred to myself. And I need to do that purposefully sometimes, because capitalism asks you to give all of what you can do to the system. And for me to thrive, it's really important for me to have spaces where, I mean, I'm like a super introvert and like, that's just something about me that, I really need those spaces to replenish and like watch trashy dating reality television and like just like turn off my brain for a little bit. And that's those are all ways that I thrive.
I love that distinction about that thriving exists in some of the areas where isn't public facing, isn't about how you make money. I really relate.
That's 100%. And so many of the things I do, I'm like, I am really obsessed with playing video games, and I also draw. And it's like, oh, I could go to school to learn about how to make video games. I could go to school to learn how to draw. I'm like, no, I'm going to keep that.
No,
I'm going to keep it to myself. If I do want to learn how to do those things, I can probably watch something on YouTube and learn my own way and not go to school.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to keep them. And not saying that school's bad and that learning how to do these things, so many people, they thrive off of that and they want to do that. But me personally, it's not.
Yeah, have that cool self-awareness. It's neat. Yeah, I love that. Thanks for that, Disney. I love these two questions. Always garner different answers, and I just it shows, like, you know, just shows how
I could have a different conversation.
The possibilities are just so massive.
Yeah,
like, they're not, as things aren't marginalized down to like a one way for everyone fits everybody, and it just shows up constantly in how people show up and answer these questions. So our kind of final question is, we like to ask for recommendations. We usually like orbit around the conversation and recommendations. Mm-hmm. So besides your wonderful work, your show and your book, like, we like to think about, we have because of Uli, we have a lot of younger folks who listen to the show. So, like, you know, maybe for young folks who are maybe facing a hard time around these issues that we're talking about, of anti-trans, anti-gay, all that, some media that they could look to, either any kind of medium, we're open to hear about, and just any recommendations that maybe helped you along the way.
I have a hard time with books right now, but I was a really big reader when I was a young person, and I love a queer YA novel. Like, any, there's such good stuff now, like that just did not exist when I was a teen. All of those books. I especially really loved Felix Ever After by Kacen Callender is beautiful. Anything by Johnny Garzavilla, I think is their full name. I might have to look that up. Beautiful Texan queer teen representation. Latine. And let's see, stuff for teens. You know, I don't generally work with teens a lot, so I don't have a ton of stuff off the top of my head.
Or anybody.
You could be any age.
Yeah.
I mean, many of my teen friends are like into kids shows and into.
Yeah.
They grew
okay,
up on that,
great.
So they watched that stuff. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm sure I'm just like preaching to the choir here, but like, Steven Universe is one of my like just all time favorite pieces of art. This is like the thing is, but as soon as someone asks you for a recommendation, your mind just like goes completely blank. I have really gotten into astrology over the past couple of years and absolutely adore the Chani app from Chani Nicholas, who is just fantastic. She's just kind of like my go-to like astrologer person, and has, I've gotten like information from like a lot of different places, but if you're a writer, I also really love Gina Cadlick's newsletter. It's called Astrology for Writers, and it's just really wonderful. I really love those kinds of things. I love the season of A League of Their Own, the remake, the reboot. I love like a historical fiction thing. And I thought that was just beautifully done. There's just like a lot of really good queer stuff that's been happening despite all of the awfulness of the world. There's just good queer art that's out there because we are brilliant. And and I just want everyone to give us money to make cool things. That would be the dream, right? Yeah, those are the things that come top of mind of like things that like I love and like some of the things that are like in my day to day as well. And what else? Yeah, I feel like those are some good places to start.
You know, it was great. Yeah, I liked hearing Steven Universe because I grew up on watching that. I watched that when it was first coming out when I was a little tiny.
Oh,
and
gosh,
I'm
yes.
currently showing it to my partner. So I've been rewatching it with them. Ugh. They've never seen it. So it's,
oh my gosh, I need to do a rewatch.
I know it's been so much fun. That also reminded me how I haven't seen the show yet, but I've never made recommendations on this. But it was just thinking like with kids shows that also are queer and stuff like that. There's that show going around right now called Bluey. I don't know if you've
seen it. Bluey's great. I don't know if it's queer, but Bluey's
yeah,
really
not
good.
Queer, but it's like. It's not
quality children's television.
Yeah,
it's,
I haven't.
It's like really beautiful.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but everyone.
It's really lovely and fun and like well written. And it's just like this really lovely family unit. And like each episode has like a nice clear structure. It's just like really. I haven't watched like all of it, but like if you're looking for, this is like the thing that I'm always about. Like if I'm like talking to like a parent with like a young kid, I'm like, okay, here are all the preschool recommendations, because like it's so easy to go, I'm not gonna like, I can't like shit talk a lot of kids media publicly, but there's like some things that it's just so easy to go to as like babysitter television. And I'm telling you that there's a lot better stuff out there. Doc McStuffins is like obviously a huge Disney property, but like also is like a great show. Chris Nee, who was the showrunner of and created Doc McStuffins, also has a show also on Disney called Vampirina that I think truly is her best work. It's gorgeous. I love Vampirina. She also has done a bunch of stuff, and so Chris Nee is queer. Like basically like the queer Shonda Rhimes of preschool television. She also has a couple of shows on Netflix that are fantastic. Ridley Jones, Spirit Rangers, which is about a trio of indigenous kids who are like land protectors essentially. And it was done by an entirely indigenous casting crew. Yeah, it's like incredible that they put that together in that way, really really intentionally. Other preschool stuff, I mean like Blue's Clues and You, like I was very into Blue's Clues when I was a kid. I got to sit in the chair once and I helped out with some of this content on their YouTube channel. So I've written for Blue, which is extremely cool. So yeah,
I want to give a shout out for Little Bear from Maurice Sendak.
Yeah,
so Winnie the Pooh.
I just really think that I'm also like I'm into like less like in your face politics and just like young people being trusted.
Yeah,
that show is like it's otherworldly because everyone trusts everybody. They're
well,
kind.
Curious, exactly, right?
Gentle.
Yeah. That's like a perfect also to like, I'm like, I'm biased because of what I like, but it's like Studio Ghibli movies are also a really good choice. Actually, there's just certain anime series that I think are good for kids. I hate that the idea that kids can't handle any of that stuff because there's like, a couple of serious topics.
Sailor Moon. I loved Sailor Moon.
Pokemon would be fine for a little kid. Oh, it's like that Pokemon. Would be a lot of fun for a little kid to watch. And
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah. I watched when I was 3 years old, like stuff like Princess Mononoke, which is quite violent.
At a friend's house.
That
was a bit.
It wasn't, it was not like, it's not like this was you guys letting me watch that. But I watched it and it's like, I mean, it's different for every kid, but I just think communicate with what your kid's like.
Oh yeah.
Honestly, your kid want to watch?
Oh my God. Like, ratings are such a sham. That's a whole other
conversation. Really are. I always got in trouble for following your guys' predilections and where you were at. There's just so much media. We will have all this in the show notes, including how people can find you, but do you want to Can you please just maybe give a little quick
where we can rundown find you?
Where people listening can find you that maybe don't read show notes?
Yes, absolutely. All the things. You can follow me on socials at Lynz Amer, LINDZAMER. All of my work is just at Queer Kid Stuff, singular kid. And queerkidstuff.com is like where all of the stuff is. We do a lot. We do things for parents. We do things for educators. We do things that are for kids and are just like content that you can bring to young people. Since this is a podcast, you can check out my podcast, Rainbow Parenting. It's an expansion of the upcoming book. And you can pre-order the book anywhere you get books. It's called Rainbow Parenting. My personal fave is bookshop.org. But you can, wherever you prefer.
Yeah, get that book, everybody. Ooh, everyone should read that book. I actually think it's for everybody.
Even the cishet.
Rainbow Parenting for everybody.
Yeah. Even if you don't have a relationship with a single child.
Yeah, you encounter them. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes, everyone read it. Well, thank you so much for being on our show. This was, it was so much illuminating.
Thank you
joyful.
For having me.
I get excited getting to talk about my stuff, the stuff that I
always
queer stuff of
trans was
stuff,
great
whatever
I don't get to answer a lot of those questions because everyone's like, oh, let me talk about your work, and I'm like, yes, I love talking about my work, but like also I have other interests.
100%. I like that we got to talk about the Magneto thing. That was a lot of fun. And just Disney and kids shows in general. That was a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh, all the time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. This is lovely.
Thanks for listening to our show. Grounded Futures is a media production and mentorship collaborative, and this podcast is produced by Carla Bergman, William Joy, Jamie Lee Gonzalez, and Melissa Sharp. And our sound tech is by Chris Bergman.
Resources and transcripts for this episode are in the show notes. If you want to donate some funds or check out our other awesome shows, head over to groundedfutures.com or email us with comments and suggestions at groundedfutures@gmail.com. And please tune in next time to hear more from our incredible guests on how to thrive in the everyday.